We're going to continue talking about the abelian Higgs model. And we showed yesterday how you can use spontaneous symmetry breaking to generate masses for a photon or photon-like particle. Now we're going to show how you can use spontaneous symmetry breaking to generate masses for fermions, which are chiral couplings. If they're not chiral, there's no problem. You can introduce a mass by hand. But if you have chiral fermions, they have chiral gauge interactions, then mass terms are forbidden by the gauge symmetry. So we need to work a little harder if we want to write down everything in a consistent way. So I'm just going to take the abelian Higgs model that we wrote down yesterday and add in a fermion. So we're going to add a fermion field, call it psi, to the model. And I'm just going to assume that it has chiral couplings. G left and G right, which are not equal to each other, to the gauge fields A mu. So in other words, psi left and psi right will transform differently under the gauge symmetry. So as we discussed before, if you have a mass term, psi bar psi, it's forbidden by the gauge symmetry. But we can generate a mass term using the Higgs fields, our scalar fields, phi. So let's just say psi bar psi is forbidden by the gauge symmetry. And so we're going to generate it spontaneously. Through spontaneous symmetry breaking. All right, so that's the basic setup. And so before we start, I just want to introduce a little bit of notation. What I'm calling G will be the gauge coupling. And then I'm also going to write Q is the charge of a given field in units of G. So now I can just write down the quantum numbers. So I have three fields, a complex scalar, which will be the Higgs scalar, or the Higgs field, and then two chiral fermion fields, side left and side right. So here's the complex scalar. It will have charge Q phi. And what I assumed before is that this is just equal to plus 1. So this is just equal to 1. So I'm free to do that. Let's just set this equal to 1. It's no big deal. It's just slightly more complicated if you don't make that choice. Now we also have psi left. And so I'll call that Q left. And psi right, which will have charge Q right. So what I wrote before is G left and G right would be G left would be Q left times the gauge field, gauge coupling G, and then G right is just Q right times G. And the assumption that I have chiral fields just means that Q left is not equal to Q right. Okay, so now let me just write down what the gauge transformations are, just to remind you again. So phi will go to e to the minus ig q phi alpha times phi. And then psi left and psi right go to e to the minus ig q left or right times alpha times the original fields. All right, so in general, for an arbitrary choice of these charges, it doesn't help you write down a fermion mass term, because you can't. But if there's one particular choice, in which the queues satisfy a certain condition, then you can write down another interaction that is gauge invariant. So if we have the following, so if we assume that Q left is equal to Q right plus Q phi, then we can write down an interaction, which is called the Yukawa interaction. That is gauge invariant. So in this case, here's the Yukawa interaction. We'll have some coupling constant in front, which I'll just call minus y. And then I have this combination of fields, psi bar left, psi right, times phi, and then plus Hermitian conjugate. So this coupling constant y is called the Yukawa coupling. Like so. So in general, I just want to emphasize that there's no reason to assume, there's no reason to think that this has to be true. It's an assumption that I want to have. All right, so if I want to generate a mass term, I need to assume that this is true to be able to write down this term consistently. But in general, all of these charges are free parameters. They could have, in principle, any value that you like. All right, so now let's see how this generates a mass term through spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the scalar sector of the theory is the same as what we did yesterday. And so I can just write down this field phi in unitary gauge. It gets a vacuum expectation value. So I should write down phi is equal to 1 over the square root of 2, v, the VEV, plus the dynamical field, the Higgs field, little h, in unitary gauge. Now I can just plug this into the Yukawa interaction. So I've got minus y, psi left bar, psi right, times v plus h, and then divided by the square root of 2. And then let me add to that the complex conjugate, which would be minus y over the square root of 2, psi bar right, psi left, and then v plus h. Now, in general, this coupling y, you could start out and say, OK, maybe it could be complex, so I should have y star. But you're free to eliminate the phase in y, for example, by absorbing it into the phase of phi. So you can take y to be a real parameter. And so that's why I don't need to write down y star over here. So now let me just combine these terms. Now I have a mass term which is not chiral at all. So I just have minus y v over the square root of 2 times psi bar psi times h, just by itself. And then I have y over the square root of 2 psi bar psi times h. So here's the mass term. The first term is the mass term. And then I have another interaction which couples the fermion to the Higgs fields. So the fermion mass is just y times the VEV divided by the square root of 2. So there we go. There's our mass. But we have this inescapable byproduct, which is that if I want to generate a mass through spontaneous symmetry breaking, then I automatically have to couple the residual scalar, the residual physical degree of freedom, which is the Higgs, to the fermion as well. And it's the same coupling involved in both. You have the same Yukawa coupling. All right. So there we go. So we've shown how spontaneous symmetry breaking can generate masses for both fermions and gauge fields. And now I want to come back to this issue of renormalizability. And I want to show that if you generate the masses in this way, then you fix the problem of having these divergences that appear when you compute things at one loop. So we started with a gauge invariant theory. Can generate gauge non-invariant terms or interactions in Lagrangian via spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this is the Higgs mechanism. So let's go back to renormalizability. But I just want to say that you have this inescapable effect where because you have the scalar generating, spontaneously breaking the gauge symmetry, you have a leftover degree of freedom, which is the Higgs. And this fixes renormalizability. So the extra residual degree of freedom H, which is the Higgs boson in this case, cures the non-renormalizability issue. And so we're not going to prove this in general, but I'm just going to sketch to you how it works so you can get a qualitative understanding for what's going on. So I just want to go back to this one-loop scattering diagram that we wrote down before. We were just considering psi to psi scattering. And then I mentioned you also have to include the diagram where you cross the photon lines. Like so. And when you add these up, let's just sketch what we had before. So each vertex gives you a factor of g. So I have g to the fourth. Then I've got some loop integral, d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. Then I'm only going to keep track of the k dependence. So the fermion propagator will give me something like k slash plus m psi over k squared. And the photon propagator, the massive photon propagator, the most divergent part will be the term that's like k mu, k nu, over ma squared, whole thing squared. And again, this is just a sketch. I'm not worrying too much about how I'm contracting the Dirac indices and the Lorentz indices. This is just a qualitative argument to show you how the diagram blows up when you do the integral. And then I just want to mention, of course, that we're integrating up to some momentum cutoff lambda. All right, so what I argued before is that the k slash term will end up canceling out. So the k slash squared term will cancel out because the effect of crossing this, of combining these two things, is that I'll have a k slash here and a minus k slash over here if you just keep track of the momentum flow. So that will cancel out the k slash squared term here. There's no term that's linear in k slash just because that whole thing would be odd under k, doesn't contribute. So everything involving a k slash term will end up canceling out. And so I'm just left with the m psi term over here. So this whole thing will be like g to the fourth, this integral d4k over 2 pi to the fourth, m psi squared over k to the fourth. And then I have k mu, k nu over ma squared, quantity squared. All right. So this whole thing, this is like a power k to the fourth. And divided by k to the fourth. Sorry, I forgot one thing. Right. I forgot about this. So the photon, I messed up the photon propagator. So let me just write down what it is. K squared minus ma squared. And then I have eta mu nu minus k mu k nu over ma squared like this. So that's what we had before for the photon propagator. So for every photon propagator, I should have, in the limit that k goes to infinity, I should have k mu k nu divided by k squared times ma squared. So I forgot to put in this k squared part over here. All right, like this. So this whole thing ends up being log divergent in the momentum cutoff. So I'll have g to the fourth m psi squared over ma to the fourth times something that's like the log of the cutoff squared. All right. Now, if I'm generating these masses through spontaneous symmetry breaking, then the mass of the fermion and the mass of the photon are related to the corresponding coupling constants times the VeV. So this whole thing I can write as g to the fourth times y squared times the VeV squared divided by g to the fourth times the VeV to the fourth times the log of the momentum cutoff squared. All right, so the g to the fourth will end up canceling off. V squared will end up canceling off two powers here. And so this whole thing will be like y squared over v squared times the log of the momentum cutoff squared. All right, so that was the diagram we had considered originally. But now we have new contributions because we have a new degree of freedom which can appear in these loops. So here's the new diagram. You can have a photon here, and you can have a Higgs, like this. Because I have a new degree of freedom, I need to include this new diagram. And then plus you can have permutations as well. You can have the Higgs over here, you can have the lines going kind of a diagonal way. And so now let's go through the same argument for this diagram as we did for this diagram and see how its divergence looks like and what couplings it's proportional to. So we have two gauge couplings and two Yukawa couplings. So the whole thing will go like g squared y squared. And then I'll have a momentum integral, which is d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. I've got two fermion propagators. And here, there's no argument about the k slash term canceling off. And so the fermion propagator should be k slash over k squared, quantity squared. And then I have, for the photon propagator, k mu k nu over k squared ma squared. And then for the scalar propagator, I just have 1 over k squared. Okay, I think I've got a mistake in my notes, but let's see if everything works out correctly now. All right, so this whole thing will, the k dependence will end up just being 1. And so here I'll have a factor of 1 over k squared. Here I've got 1 over k squared, so I'll have 1 over k to the fourth. Integrated d4k gives us something that's log divergent in the cutoff. Okay. So this whole thing will go like g squared y squared over ma squared times the log of the cutoff squared, like this. And so now, again, let me use the fact that the mass is related to the VeV times the coupling. And so this whole thing will just go like y squared over v squared times the log of lambda squared. So this is the cancellation. I haven't shown you, I haven't kept track of the numerical factors in front. But if you did, you would see that these two things exactly cancel off. The thing I did keep track of is how the couplings and the masses appear in these divergent parts. And it illustrates the fact that it's because the couplings and the masses are related to each other that this cancellation occurs. So that's the argument. So in a nutshell, the prediction from a spontaneously broken gauge theory is that you have to have this extra degree of freedom around, and its couplings have to be proportional to the masses of the states that it gives mass to. So for example, I could write down the Feynman rules. Write it down over here. So the prediction is that you have an extra scalar, and the couplings are related to the mass. And what I mean by this is the couplings to whatever state that it's giving mass to is related to the mass of that state. So just to be concrete, if I write down the Feynman rules for the Higgs going into two massive photons, a mu and a nu, the Feynman rule is 2i times the mass of the photon squared divided by the VeV, and then delta, eta mu nu. Similarly, the Higgs also couples to the fermions, and the Feynman rule is also proportional to the mass of the fermion. Since it's the same Yukawa coupling that's giving the mass as is giving the coupling. Okay. So this is just a sketch for how spontaneously broken theories cure the pathologies that arise when you try to break a gauge symmetry explicitly. Okay. So I guess next in my notes, I had planned to talk about the non-abelian Higgs model, but you guys covered it during tutorial yesterday, so we'll move on. Since you've covered the non-abelian Higgs model in SU2 and SU2 cross U1, you know everything that we need to know to write down the standard model. And so we'll just jump into that. So this is it. We're going to write down the standard model Lagrangian. Get ready. The first thing we need to do is specify what is the gauge group, and what are the degrees of freedom, and what are the quantum numbers under the gauge group. And then we can write down the interactions. So here's the gauge group. There will be an SU3 symmetry for color. So you can write this as SU3C. This is the theory of QCD. And then the electroweak sector is SU2 left, which you denote by the L here, cross U1 For hypercharge, what you denote as U and Y. So this is the electroweak gauge group. And L stands for left, meaning it only couples to left-handed chiral components. And Y is hypercharge, which I guess just means that it's similar to electric charge, but not exactly. And there's no fundamental reason to have these as the gauge groups of, you know, in particle physics. It's all based on trying to pick the theory that explains the data consistently. And it turns out that this is what you need. So now let's write down the fields and what their quantum numbers are. And I'm going to denote the quantum numbers by the quantum numbers or the representation under color, the representation under SE2 left, and then I'm going to denote their hypercharged quantum numbers like this. So it'll be a triplet. There'll be the representation under SE3 and SE2, and then whatever the U1 charge is, the hypercharge for that state. So first, I'll write down the quarks. We have a left-handed quark field, Q left I, which is a doublet under SE2. So I can write it as U left I, D left I. I stands for generation. And so it also turns out that there's three generations. And so I is just an index that goes from 1 to 3. The quantum numbers are, it's in the fundamental representation of color. It's a doublet under SE2 left. So that's the doublet I wrote down here. And under hypercharge, the hypercharge is 1/6. So this is the hypercharge and units of the gauge coupling. Next, I have U right I, which is a triplet under color, a singlet under SE2 left, and then the hypercharge is just 2/3. And then I have D right I, which is similar, 3, 1, and then -1/3. So those are the quarks. Now the leptons, L left I. So this will denote the left-handed lepton doublet, which has components of neutrinos. So it should be nu left I, E left I. And the quantum numbers are, OK, it doesn't have any color because it's a lepton, so it's a singlet under color. It's a doublet under SE2, so that's the doublet structure I wrote there. And then the hypercharge is -1/2. Then we have the right-handed electron. So again, it's no color, no SE2 left, and then -1 under hypercharge. I haven't written down the neutrino, the right-handed neutrino, but let me just write it down in parentheses. So we're neglecting neutrino masses. But if I wanted to write down a right-handed neutrino, it would have quantum numbers 1, 1, 0. So that means it's a singlet under color, it's a singlet under SE2 left, and it carries no hypercharge. So this means that it is effectively neutral under all of the gauge symmetries of the standard model. And since it doesn't participate in the gauge interactions, doesn't have any gauge interactions. So we'll come back to this. So let me just put this in parentheses. We'll come back to it at the end of the course. But for now, let's neglect it. So those are all the fermions. Now we also have a Higgs boson. So we have a Higgs scalar, which I'll call capital H. This is also a doublet under SE2 left. And so I can write its components under SE2 left like this. And its quantum numbers are 1, 2, and then 1/2. So it's a singlet under colored, doublet under SE2, which is what I wrote here. And then it has hypercharged 1/2. The plus and the zero will end up just denoting the electric charge that comes out. So for now, just think of it as a label, and we'll see that it's going to be related to electric charge. All right, so lastly, let me just write down what I mentioned before. I is equal to 1 and 2 or 3 labels the generation. Of each fermion. So there we are. It's a mystery why things come in three copies, also known as families. So here we go. Those are the fermion fields and the scalar fields. And we don't really have an understanding of why we need to write down exactly these fields with exactly these quantum numbers. We're just taking the point of view of what is the minimal number of degrees of freedom and what are the quantum numbers that we need to have to adequately describe the data. That's the philosophy. Why are these hyperchargers, for example, what they are? We don't really know, although there are some ideas. All right, so those are the fermions and the scalars, and then we also have the gauge bosons, which are, of course, determined once you write down the gauge symmetry. All right, so I'll just write down what the gauge bosons are. So we have, first we have SU3 color, and the gauge field will be known as the gluon field, which I'll denote as G mu with a capital index A. A will just run over all of the generators of SU3, so that means that A is equal to 1, 2, 8. And then the gauge coupling I'll denote as G sub S for strong interaction. Now I have SE2 left. The field I'll denote as WA sub mu, where A is equal to 1, 2, or 3, running over the three generators of SE2. And the gauge coupling will be denoted by G. Then I'll have U1 hypercharge. And the gauge field is denoted by B mu. And OK, there's no indices. It's just a U1. And the gauge coupling I'll call G prime, like so. So those are all the players in the standard model. And now we'll write down the Lagrangian. So the Lagrangian of the standard model, let me divide it up into certain terms. So we can start out with the gauge term, which will include the field strength tensors for the gauge fields. We have the fermion terms. We have the scalar sector involving the scalar field H, and then we have Yukawa interactions, which we'll get to last. So we're just going to discuss each of these terms one at a time. So the gauge terms are perhaps very familiar for non-abelian gauge fields. I should just write 1/2. And then the trace of the gauge fields, like this. So that's for SU3 color. I have the same thing for SU2 left. And then for hypercharge, I have 1/4, b mu nu. All right, so that's the gauge part. Now, for the fermions, let me start over on a different board. So for every fermion that I wrote down, it has a kinetic term. And the kinetic term is just psi bar I d slash covariant derivative psi. And then I just want to sum over all of the different species that I wrote down. And so we're going to expand this in a few minutes. But let me just write down to start with the scalar term. So this is d mu h squared. So I'll write d mu h dagger, d mu h, and then minus the potential, which is a function of the scalar fields. And the potential is as follows, minus mu squared h dagger h plus lambda h dagger h squared. And so it looks very similar to the Abelian-Higgs model. Question?
Down there, you mean the field string when you use students?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So
the same symbol.
Yeah. Apologize for the confusion. Yeah. So this should mean the field strength. So for example, g mu nu is okay. Not the metric tensor, but it's d mu g nu minus g nu g mu. And then I guess there's some non-abelian part as well, which I don't remember how to write down. Maybe I should have written it down for b mu. OK, wouldn't be embarrassed. All right. But yes, field strength tensor. All right, so let's go back to the potential. It's exactly the same as what I wrote down for the complex scalar field in the Abelian-Higgs model. I'm forbidden to have, for example, a linear term and a cubic term due to the gauge symmetry, either the SU2 left or the U1 hypercharge gauge symmetry. So these are the terms that I have to write down. Mu squared, I want to take to be a positive number. And so the fact that I have minus mu squared here will give me spontaneous symmetry breaking. And lambda has to be a positive number just so that the Hamiltonian is bounded from below. All right, so first we're going to consider the scalar part of the Lagrangian. And I believe you went through all of this part in tutorial. But maybe I'll just sketch out and summarize what we have. So we're going to consider first this part of the Lagrangian, and we're going to work in unitary gauge. Where the Higgs fields is 1 over the square root of 2, 0, and then V plus H. Where V, in order to minimize the potential, is mu squared over lambda. This would be the Higgs VEV. All right, so now let me start out by just expanding the covariant derivative. So d mu h will be, okay, so the covariant derivative will be d mu. And then I just need to include all of the gauge interactions. So to start out with, I'll have SU2. So I'll have I g over 2 sigma a w a mu. G is the gauge coupling. And then sigma over 2, the Pauli matrix divided by 2, is the generator for SU2. And then I contract that with the field, and then sum over the generators A. Then I have a hypercharge. So I'll have I G prime over 2 B mu. And again, G prime is the gauge coupling. And then the factor of 1 over 2 just comes from the fact that the hypercharge of the Higgs field is 1 half. That's why I have a 1 half there. And then this whole thing is acting on 1 over square root of 2, 0, v plus h, like so. So let me expand this out. I have d mu plus I over 2. And then I'm going to write both of these terms as just a matrix. So I'll have G W3 mu plus G prime B mu. And then down here, I'll have G W3 mu plus G prime B mu. So the B, the hypercharge gauge fields, there's no SU2 part. So there's no SU2 matrix. It's just proportional to the identity matrix in SU2. And so that's why it's living along the diagonal. The three parts will be proportional to Pauli matrix 3. And so I'll have plus and minus down here. And then the 1 half is over there. And so then I have the 1 and 2 components, which live along the off diagonals, since the Pauli matrix 1 and 2 are off diagonal. So I'll have G. And then I'll have the combination of W mu 1 minus I W mu 2. And then I'll have G W mu 1 plus I W mu 2, like so. And then all of that will be acting on the Higgs field H, 1 over square root of 2, 0, V plus H. OK. So now I can just expand this out a little bit, because this part's pretty simple. It only has one non-zero component. So let me multiply that matrix by that vector. So I'll have d mu h is equal to 1 over the square root of 2, 0 d mu h plus I, 1 over the square root of 2, 1 half. V plus H times the vector of G W mu 1 minus I W mu 2. And then I'll have minus G W mu 3 plus G prime B mu. OK. So I'm just multiplying these things out. And now I can take the square of the covariant derivative pretty easily. So when I compute d mu h dagger times d mu h, This whole thing will be 1/2 d mu h squared plus g squared over 8 times v plus h squared times w1 squared plus w2 squared. And then I'll have one last term. V plus h squared, g w3 mu minus b mu g prime squared, like this. Okay, so when I expand this out, it ends up being pretty simple. But of course, as you probably learned during tutorial, the VEV term here will generate mass terms for the w3 and the b, including off-diagonal terms that mix W3 and B. And so we want to diagonalize the W3B mass matrix to see what the mass eigenstates are. So you can also make a field redefinition for W1 and W2. Since they appear in this particular linear combination, you can treat them as a complex field, which we'll call W plus and its conjugate W minus. So we want to make some field redefinitions. So we'll define W plus and W minus as 1 over the square root of 2 W1 mu minus plus I W2 mu. We want to define Z mu as cosine theta W, W3 mu minus sine theta W B mu. And then we want to define A mu, which will end up being the photon, as sine theta W, W3, plus cosine theta W, B mu. So theta W is called the weak mixing angle, sometimes known as the Weinberg angle, although Weinberg wasn't the first person to write it down. That's how it goes. The weak mixing angle is defined by the tangent of theta W is just G prime over G. So we can relate G prime to G just by multiplying by tangent of theta W. Or we can write this as G sine theta W over cosine theta W, just expanding out what tangent is. So now I can just expand this particular linear combination here using the weak mixing angle to relate it to the mass eigenstates A and Z. So G W3 mu minus G prime B mu, if you just use the relations that we wrote down, it's just equal to G over cosine theta W times Z mu. So that's exactly the linear combination that appears here. It's related to the field Z. Where does A mu appear? It doesn't, of course. We want the photon to be massless. So it doesn't appear in the mass matrix for these gauge fields. So expanding that out, we have d mu h dagger d mu h ends up being equal to 1/2 d mu h squared. So we have the kinetic term for the Higgs. And then we have the mass terms for the gauge bosons. So this ends up being g squared b squared divided by 4 w mu plus w mu minus But then I also have couplings of the Higgs scalar H, right? It's not just V squared that appears here, it's V squared plus H squared. And so I should multiply this by 1 plus H over V squared. And then similarly, I have G squared V squared over 8 cosine theta W squared times Z mu. And then again, the Higgs couples to this as well, like so. OK, so this is what I get. And so I can just read off what the mass terms are for the W and the Z. You get MW is equal to G V over 2. And MZ is equal to G V over 2 cosine theta W. So when I write CW, this will be equal to cosine theta W. And then SW will be sine theta W, like so. OK, so here we have masses for the W and the Z. And the nice thing is that they're not equal to each other, which is an experimentally verified fact. Because a cosine is always less than 1, the mass of the Z will always be greater than the mass of the W, which is also true. So actually, the two masses are related to one another, modulo this factor of cosine theta W. As we'll show tomorrow, cosine theta W, or sine theta W, also enter into the weak couplings of the W and Z to, for example, fermions. So it's possible to independently measure the weak mixing angle independent of the masses. You just measure how the W and the Z couple, or I should say the Z couples to fermions. And so it's possible to measure all of these three things simultaneously, the mass of the W, the mass of the Z, and the weak mixing angle. And if you put them together in a particular linear combination, which I'll denote rho, so let's define rho to be mw squared over mz squared cosine theta w squared. This must be equal to 1. Which is true at tree level. So if you just plug in these values, it must be equal to 1. And so if you measure these three things independently, the mass of the W, the mass of the Z, and the weak mixing angle, you just form a ratio. You can test whether or not rho is equal to 1 or if it's not equal to 1. So it is equal to 1, modulo higher order corrections, which tells us that this picture of spontaneous symmetry breaking through a Higgs doublet ends up being the correct way to break SE2 left, cross U1. If you had chosen a different representation for the Higgs field, you would have gotten a different answer. If you had included a doublet plus something else, you also get a different answer. So this is really telling us that, at least to a good approximation, it's really only the Higgs doublet which is playing a role in spontaneous symmetry breaking of the gauge fields. OK. So then I just want to mention one other thing, that the photon is massless. There's no mass term for the photon that appears. So that's good. We have a massless photon in nature. So A mu remains massless. So this is going to be the photon fields. And we'll see that it will end up coupling to something we can define as electric charge when we talk about fermions. So what we've accomplished so far through the Higgs is we've spontaneously broken SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge to a smaller group, which is unbroken, because we still have a gauge field that's massless. We still have an unbroken symmetry, which will end up being electromagnetism. So the electroweak symmetry is broken to U1 of electromagnetism. We can also count the degrees of freedom just to make sure it all makes sense. We had three generators for SE2 left, and then one generator for U1. So we have four gauge fields in our initial theory. Each gauge field being massless has 2 degrees of freedom. So that would be 8 degrees of freedom. We also have the Higgs sector, which is a scalar. It's a scalar doublet. Each component of the doublet is a complex scalar. So that's another 4 degrees of freedom. So I'll just write the gauge part is 4, and the scalar part is 8, and the scalar part is 4 degrees of freedom. And it gets broken to 3 massive gauge bosons. Which each have 3 degrees of freedom. So that's equal to 9. And we also have one unbroken gauge boson. So that's equal to 11. And then we have one Higgs scalar, which is another 1. So we started with 12 degrees of freedom, and we end up with 12, which is good. 3 of the scalar degrees of freedom get eaten to become the 3 longitudinal modes of the massive gauge bosons. But again, it leaves over 1 remaining degree of freedom, which is the Higgs boson. OK, so that's a good place to stop for now. When we pick up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the fermion terms. We're going to talk about the gauge interactions of the fermions. And then we'll talk about Yukawa interactions in generating mass terms.